Case numbers 22-3148 and 22-3377, Total Quality Logistics LLC versus Traffic Tech Incorporated et al. 15 minutes for the plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Mr. Wiles, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Matt Wiles. I represent Total Quality Logistics. We are the appellant in the appeal from the district court's order denying the motion to compel arbitration, and we are the appellee in the appeal of the district court's April 2022 order clarifying an injunction.
Is there any way we can mediate this dispute? It seems it's about 15, 16 months in. Did you try mediation with our Kathy Geyer shop?
We did, Your Honor. It was not successful, unfortunately.
Uh-huh. Was there mediation tried at the trial level?
No, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. Is it worth our pushing it some more?
On the mediation front,
yeah.
Your Honor, from TQL's perspective, respectfully, we do not think so at this time.
Okay.
I think we would want to get a little bit further into discovery and figure out some questions that we have about what happened before we would be willing to entertain those discussions.
I see. Okay.
I want to start with the latter appeal I discussed, the appeal from the district court's April 2022 order, and specifically whether or not that appeal is moot. The court had requested supplemental briefing on that question because the injunctive order expired a little more than 2 months ago now. Traffic Tech and Duggar are arguing that the bond exception to mootness applies here, and it's why the appeal is not moot. We disagree with that notion. They argued that they have a damage claim.
Wasn't bond mandatory under the language of Rule 65?
No, Your Honor. The Sixth Circuit has consistently interpreted Rule 65 for decades to not require
it. The language seems to make it mandatory, right?
Well, the language, the way that the court has dealt with the issue, the Sixth Circuit has dealt
I guess, let me ask my question again. The language seems to make it mandatory, correct?
The language does, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then both the Supreme Court and our court have said where a bond doesn't issue, right, but arguably should have, that it's not moot any longer. Am I right about that?
You're right about that, Your Honor. But the precedent in this circuit is that the district court is under an obligation to consider the bond issue. And the language from the opinions of this court make it clear that they have discretion whether to set it at zero.
Two more questions, and I'll be quiet. What happens, let's assume my hypothetical is right, don't fight it, that the district court wrongfully issues an injunction. The injunction lasts a year. The injunction expires, but there's no bond. Is there no recourse if there's no permanent injunction, like in this case?
There would be no recourse if bond is set at zero. Correct.
Even if the bond determination was wrong?
If the bond determination was wrong itself and the party raised that issue below, then I think if the party raised that issue below, then yes, there may be some recourse on a remand to set the bond.
So my final question is this. Did they ask for bond below?
No, they did not. We combined it as a motion for a TRO and a preliminary injunction. That was filed in state court. Then it was removed, and so now it's subject to Rule 65. The parties then had an opportunity to submit briefing, and the defendants below submitted briefing in excess of 30 pages and opposed several portions of the TRO but never actually addressed the security issue at all. And then once the injunctive order was issued in December, it also was not addressed for several months. The first time that the bond
How does it work that trial judges are supposed to consider bonds? You're saying no one raised the point of a bond?
No, the defendants did not argue that a bond should be issued at any point below.
Mm-hmm.
And that was neither after the injunctive order was issued, nor in the intervening months, nor when the trial court indicated that it was willing to consider clarifying the TRO. The bond issue has never been raised except in this court. The point I was trying to make earlier was that the trial court has an obligation under this court's precedent in Rule 65 to consider whether a bond is required. So they can consider whether, or the trial court can consider whether it's zero, $50,000, $100,000.
Do they have to sua sponte, or do they have to, is a request a prerequisite?
I believe that the district court has to consider the issue under the language of the rule, which the district court did here.
Well, since the language of the rule hasn't seemed to make a difference, do our cases say that you have to sua sponte, every trial judge has to sua sponte, raise bond issues? Well, why? That seems incredibly strange to me.
I'm not sure if that phrasing has been used in the court's precedent, but I'm not aware of a situation that I can think of off the top of my head, Your Honor, where the trial court said nothing about the bond. So in our view, the trial court has to consider the issue and provide a reasoning for what it is doing for the security bond. But beyond that, I don't think there's any other requirement. And so if the trial court sets the bond at zero, and that's the point of the cases that were cited in their letter briefing, dealt with the Norris LaGuardia Act, and Section 7 of that act provides a statutory cause of action against a bond that is required. But even if you extend it, and that has not been the case with Rule 65. The rulings have been different. But even if you extend that to here, they made clear that it's specifically held the statute allows recovery only in relation to the bond. So if the bond was set at zero and there are damages of, let's say, $10,000 from a wrongfully issued injunction, your recovery is zero, even under that case law.
Did the trial court consider the bond in December or only in April?
In December.
Okay.
The
relation back from the April order means he's considered it at every phase.
Yes, he's considered it. And the April order only clarified the duration of the injunctive order. And that is all that the defendants asked the trial court to do, was to consider the duration of it. Well, first they said it should be dissolved. And they said, alternatively, the trial court retains jurisdiction to clarify the duration, which is a proposition that we don't disagree with. The trial court, even to this day, still has the ability to modify or terminate the injunction. It's just never been asked to do so by the defendants until we get to this court.
So give me your punchline on mootness. Go ahead with the punchline.
Mootness was... Sorry, Your Honor. The case is not moot due to the bond issue because no bond was ever issued.
What if one takes the view that if one wasn't requested, it can't be abuse of discretion not to consider it, therefore the bond issue's out of the case? Because we would say it wasn't abuse of discretion because, hey, we have an adversarial system, no one raised the point, it's not on the judge, and we're not going to call that an abuse of discretion. So essentially, rule on the bond issue, number one. If we did that, wouldn't the injunction be moot at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And even you would not like us to do that because?
I'm not sure I'm actually arguing anything different than what the court's saying.
Okay.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding the question.
So you would agree it is moot as long as we say, hey, no abuse of discretion?
Yes. It would be in that instance, yes, Your Honor.
Right.
If the court is able to get to the merits and say this case is not particularly moot, we still think that the appeal should be dismissed. And we're in sort of this odd situation where the actual injunctive order from December has never been appealed. It's not before the court. They only appealed the April order.
Well, the December order said it's a TRO, and it specifically says in the footnote,
yes,
they're not deciding the PI.
Yes, that's precisely correct.
So it's a little unfair, right, to ask them to appeal the December order.
Well, I think what the trial court said was that the December order is tantamount to a preliminary injunction, which provides them with appellate rights if it's tantamount to a preliminary injunction. Our point would be
they appealed the April order, so they timely appealed, right?
Yes, they appealed the April order. The April order only clarified the duration of the injunction. It did not do anything else except that. And I think that's because that's all they asked the court to do, was clarify that. They at no point did they go to the trial court and say, we believe that the evidence is insufficient to fulfill the requirements of Rule 65, and therefore you should terminate the TRO. That argument's never been made except here. We believe that that argument is best directed at the trial court, the arguments they're making on appeal, because the trial court is the one who's familiar with this matter. Several of the issues they raise involve evidentiary matters that the trial court is in a better position to first consider. So we think even if the appeal is not moot, we still think the arguments are better directed at the trial court in the first instance before bringing it to the Court of Appeals. I see that my time is up.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right.
We'll hear from the other side.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Robin Miller with Stites & Harbison on behalf of Appellee Nicholas Duggar. For the purpose of the two cases that have been consolidated, I will be arguing TQL's appeal, which is case number 223148. My co-counsel, who represents Traffic Tech, it will be arguing case number 223377 based on the argument that just took place in the questions. If the court would prefer to hear the bond issues and the arguments related to that, we're happy to swap.
No, just get going.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. The district court's denial of TQL's motion to compel arbitration should be affirmed for several reasons. First, TQL waived its right to arbitrate that matter by acting and engaging in conduct inconsistent with a right to arbitrate. In other words, Mr. Duggar, in the very first instance, in opposition to TQL's motion for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, asserted the unclean hands defense. TQL, in reply, did not raise the arbitration agreement, did not bring it to the court's attention, and thereby the court issued an order granting, in part, TQL's motion for a temporary restraining order. For several months, 2 months, we then engaged in discovery, motion practice, additional litigation, and only when TQL received an unfavorable decision ordering it to provide discovery on the unclean hands defense did TQL then assert the motion to compel arbitration. We believe for that reason at this point it is waived. Second, and more fundamental really to the issues, unclean hands is a defense. It's not a claim. Mr. Duggar only asserted the defense in response to TQL's request for injunctive relief. And Judge Black found that that is a defense that is available to him. TQL has not appealed that finding, has not appealed that decision from the court. It's undisputed, and I think this is important, Your Honors, Mr. Duggar has not asserted any claims in the underlying litigation. Based on the time of service, his response of pleading was not even yet due at the time that this appeal was initiated. So he has asserted no claims in the underlying litigation.
I take it there's a way in which unclean hands is still relevant?
Yes, Your Honor. As Judge Black found, the unclean hands defense, it's based on improper pay practices. But the fact that it could be available to him as an affirmative claim under the FLSA, it does not preclude him from asserting that the facts giving rise to that caused TQL to have unclean hands with regard to his employment. TQL makes various allegations in the complaint that the consideration for the signing the non-compete, they would not have put him through the training, they would not have paid him, they would not have done these things but for signing the non-compete agreement is the consideration. So they relate, they are tied to one another, and the fact that he asserted it as a defense, if he wanted to, he could bring it as a counterclaim, but he has not done so. He's not yet had the opportunity even to do that, Your Honor. As Judge Black noted, the arbitration agreement itself has a 400-word list of what constitutes a legal claim, and it does not even gesture toward the possibility that a legal claim includes a defense. Now, trying to distance itself from the words claim and defense, TQL has postured the matter in this appeal as improper pay practice issues. Well, just like the arbitration agreement is silent as to defenses, it also is silent as to issues. You will not find in the arbitration agreement, which is cited in the addendum as Record Evidence 22-1, there is no reference to to issues being arbitrated and other issues not being arbitrated. So it's clear from the very face of the arbitration agreement that only claims are to be arbitrated.
What about the presumption in favor of arbitrability?
And
the fact that some other things are carved out. So you have some carve-outs, but no carve-out for defenses, and then you have this presumption. Isn't there enough ambiguity, given the carve-outs, that the presumption comes in?
Well, we certainly appreciate and respect that there is a presumption in favor of arbitration. However, it's not absolute, and it's a matter of contract. And Mr. Duggar can only be compelled to arbitrate the things to which he agreed to arbitrate. And there's nothing in the arbitration agreement to which TQL can point to and say Mr. Duggar agreed to arbitrate defenses to injunctive relief that's requested in litigation. With regard to the ambiguity, Your Honor, I would posit that TQL is responsible for any ambiguity as the sole drafter of the agreement. It was a contract of adhesion with no opportunity for Mr. Duggar to negotiate it or decline to sign it if he wanted the employment. So if there is ambiguity, Your Honor, that is to be held against TQL. Now, Judge Black's conclusion is further supported by, if you look at the definition section, which again is very lengthy, it's two-thirds of the first page of the arbitration agreement that defines what is to be arbitrated, there is a section within that that relates to improper pay practices. And that section says that legal claims shall include, but are not limited to, claims for wages, compensation, salary, overtime, and then there's a catch-all for any other claims for compensation, including claims under the FLSA. Now, Your Honor, somewhat in response to your question, I have to note that if unclean hands can be a legal claim under the arbitration agreement, then it renders the mandate for arbitration and the exclusions for arbitration directly in competition.
Can I ask you one practical question?
Yes.
I mean, how would this actually work in terms of having this unclean hands defense arbitrated? That would need to be arbitrated first, I mean, separately, however long that might take, and the underlying litigation would be suspended until the arbitration occurred. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I suppose that's how it would play out, Your Honor. I also would suggest that carving out, extracting a sole defense to be arbitrated while the rest of the matter, the issues, the claims, and it all is going to surround the same set of facts to be litigated while the defense...
It seems like it might really prolong the litigation process.
It would prolong the litigation process. It causes more expense and distraction, and frankly, we believe, Your Honor, is just not feasible, nor is it required under the arbitration agreement.
Okay, thank you.
As I was saying, TQL's interpretation of the agreement, for example, Judge Black undertook an effort to say, let's replace the words legal claim with equitable defense. And what that resulted is an absurd result, whereby what would be mandated to be arbitrated, a legal claim, also provides, there's an exception for injunctive relief and declaratory judgment claims. And if an equitable defense is an issue related to injunctive relief and the non-compete, you have the result where the unclean hands defense is both mandated and yet excluded at the same time, which we cannot have. I see my time is up. I will defer to my colleague.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. Pamela Abate Dottillo on behalf of Traffic Tech. And I will be arguing the appeal in which we are the appellant regarding the injunction order. So to be clear, the order that we have appealed is the April 14th, 2022 order, and there is no reference anywhere in that order to a bond. The court does not consider...
There is in the December one, and he was retroactively incorporating that, and I looked at your response. You never asked for bond, did you?
So I'll answer respond to both of your points. First of all, it's not permissible under Rule 65 to simply incorporate by reference prior documents. And so we need to consider it on the face of the order. On the face of the order, there is no bond that is required. There's no bond that is even discussed. As to your question regarding whether we requested a bond, we did not seek a bond in connection with the TRO because...
Did you move for reconsideration of either order to ask for bond?
So I have to answer that separately. As to the TRO, we did not request a bond in connection with the TRO because everyone, the court and the parties, was in agreement that this would be a very limited order that would get us to an injunction hearing. And in my experience, it makes more sense to put on evidence regarding the appropriate amount of a bond at that PI hearing. Because at the time the TRO is being briefed, neither side has any idea what kind of
TRO and PI, right?
They are different because there's a much higher emphasis on irreparable harm. The factors are the same.
I'm sorry, for the bond, I apologize. Rule 65 says a temporary restraining or a preliminary injunction.
Correct.
If it issues either, a security shall issue.
Correct. I'm explaining why we didn't in the context of the TRO because we all understood this was going
to be... What about the PI?
A limited measure. On the preliminary injunction motion, there was never a preliminary injunction motion filed.
You file a motion for reconsideration?
We did not file a motion for reconsideration, nor were we required to. But I'd like to explain how that April 14th order came to be. So there was a TRO that was supposed to be limited duration, and at the preliminary injunction hearing, we would put on our evidence as to the bond and other issues. Then we had these discovery disagreements based on TQL's refusal to cooperate with the judge's orders, requiring them to produce discovery into the improper pay practices.
So is your argument the whole mootness rises and falls on how we interpret the April 14th order?
Yes. I think two exceptions apply. The bond exception applies, but also the capable of repetition yet evading review also applies.
How is that?
Because these are parties that, this is a matter of public record, this is the third lawsuit between them. In every single lawsuit, TQL has moved for injunctive relief. There is another lawsuit that was pending in the Federal District Court for the Southern District of Ohio, Total Quality Logistics versus Jeffrey Burdick and Traffic Tech.
Be better off without each other? It seems...
Well, my client's position is that it has a right to hire qualified, competent employees, and that TQL's use of non-compete agreements to attempt to discourage movement in the labor market, and then
non-compete's expired, right? So your client is hired now by Traffic Tech. Judge Black never stopped that; he let him continue to work there, and the non-compete's expired.
So my client is Traffic Tech, but I understand. You're referring to Mr. Duggar. Mr. Duggar is no longer employed at Traffic Tech, due directly as a result of this injunction. And that is part of the reason the bond is so important, is that Mr. Duggar has been damaged, Traffic Tech has been damaged. One thing I do not want it to be lost on the court today is that this injunction ordered Traffic Tech to cease doing all business whatsoever with a customer by the name of United Pipe. Not just stop aiding and abetting or assisting Mr. Duggar, acting in concert with him as we often see in an injunction order, but even apart from Mr. Duggar, they were ordered to cease doing business for 10 months. So we have a district court that has ordered two companies to cease doing business with one another without a hearing, without notice, for 10 months, without any explanation. You can read both of the orders, the December 8th order or the April 14th order. Neither of them explain what the basis is for telling two corporations that they are not permitted to do business together for 10 months. Traffic Tech has been damaged through the issuance of that injunction. There's no justification for that piece of the injunction in either order, and they intend to seek damages as a result. Now, I do want to get back to, I never fully answered the question, is why there isn't a bond in connection with that April 14th order. TQL was refusing to cooperate with discovery. We brought multiple motions to compel. The court sided with us every single time, ordering TQL to produce the documents. They then brought an emergency motion to compel arbitration to avoid having to produce the discovery. The court denied that order. They took an immediate appeal, February 23rd, 2022. They took an immediate appeal and filed an emergency motion to stay the entire proceedings. We were given one day by Judge Black to respond to that motion to stay the proceedings. In that one day we had, we raised in our opposition memo that, well, we don't necessarily oppose a stay, but let's be clear that the TRO is now dissolved because we're now months off track. They've abandoned their motion for a temporary injunction or preliminary injunction. We're clearly not having that hearing since they want all proceedings stayed. So we'd just like an order clarifying that. We then waited months to get the April 14th order from the court in which he said, actually, it did not expire, and I'm going to extend it without a hearing that everyone has been anticipating, without the discovery we've been anticipating, and this is now going to remain in effect until September 14th, 2022.
Did anyone raise up the bond point then?
Well, we had one day to file a brief, and so we did not raise a bond because we weren't anticipating that he would do what he did.
After that day, lawyers are known for filing further pleadings, has been my experience.
Well, correct, and I did file further pleadings. We were so concerned about the delay in issuing that order, concerned with the fact that we were...
Did anyone raise bond, and why not?
I brought it immediately to the Sixth Circuit in a motion, because I felt that expedient way to get relief.
What did you bring immediately to the Sixth Circuit?
I brought a motion to stay enforcement of the injunction or to order a bond to be posted. The way I read the rules, we had the option to either go to the district court or the Sixth Circuit. I felt, given the delays there had been with the district court, that we might get quicker relief with the Sixth Circuit. Also would like to point out that in Michigan American versus Matrick, a case decided by this court in 2009, cited in our letter, 589 F3rd 851, this court held that the party in our position is not required to move the court, the district court, for a bond. A bond must be posted with the caveat that the Sixth Circuit has acknowledged that there's discretion for the district court, but if the court fails to order a bond and this court determines it should have, it is not required that the party in our position actually bring that motion before the district court. With that, I see my time is up. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wells, you have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to try not to skip around too much on this. I want to primarily deal with the arbitrability appeal. But I will say that on the bond issue, counsel said a lot there, but the idea of the district court prohibiting two corporations from doing business with each other, that also was in the original order in December. No complaint was ever made below about that part of the injunction, including as part of a motion for reconsideration to dissolve, nothing. And I think the reason that that's in place is because Traffic Tech did not have a relationship with this company. This guy had the relationship with the company while he was working for my client. Then he went there and immediately solicited a significant amount of business. So not restraining Traffic Tech in that particular situation would allow Traffic Tech to just profit off of his violation of his contract, knowingly, by the way, which isn't disputed. On the arbitrability, counsel mentions that the definition is 400-something words, but that's not really true. The definition is the first sentence of that particular paragraph. Legal claims shall include any and all of the parties' rights, causes of action, or claims against or between one another that arise out of the employment. What we pointed out in our brief was that Mr. Duggar, by asserting that he was misclassified in violation of the FLSA and that he was underpaid his commissions, is certainly asserting rights related to his employment. Now, he might call it a defense, but it is still saying, you know, district court, I'm asserting these particular rights under the law, and the district court would have to decide if he has those rights. So it fits within the general definition of the arbitration agreement. I don't think there's any doubt, and they never even addressed that in their brief. They focused on the word claims. It says rights, claims, and causes of action. And I do agree with counsel and the court that the analysis is essentially textual. It's just looking at this contract. There's no dispute about the law. It's what does this contract
say? What's your response to what Judge Cole said earlier about it being kind of an inefficient process if you single out the defense for arbitration?
I agree wholeheartedly with what Judge Cole said, and I think where this comes in is housing this under the label of an affirmative defense. Counsel said, and they've said in the record, that they intend to assert a counterclaim for a claim under the FLSA and underpaid commissions. Now, I don't think anyone would disagree. If they assert that as a counterclaim, it falls within the scope of this agreement. So what they're essentially arguing is that they're able to litigate it as a defense, but they have to arbitrate the exact same thing as a counterclaim. That would make no sense, and there is case law from this circuit and otherwise that where you have a mix like that of something that's clearly arbitrable and something that's not, you send it all to arbitration, not part of it. But the agreement focuses on the substance of it, not the label. Just because they say it's an affirmative defense that I was misclassified in violation of the FLSA, it's still a claim. Despite what they call it, that is a claim that they're making. So in addition to rights, which I don't think anybody's even disagreed with, it falls within that. It also falls within the term claims. And claims, the definition is that first sentence, and then you have a number of examples, non-exclusive examples. And in the examples, it's always claims for something, claims for affirmative relief. But the definition itself, the general definition, is not so limited. It doesn't say claims for relief. It just says claims. And in fact, I would argue that it can't be claims for relief in the general definition because you have causes of action there, which is the same thing. And it could be that I can't think of another definition for cause of action, but a cause of action is a claim for relief. So if we want the general term of claims in that definition to mean something different, it has to be something short of an affirmative cause of action. It could be a contention. It could be something less. But I still think the point is, well, we could have the debate all day about what claims means in that general definition. It's still an assertion of their rights. There's no doubt about that. So it's covered unless it's otherwise excluded. And the only exclusion part of the agreement clearly doesn't apply. Claims for a declaratory judgment, injunctive relief, or any other causes of action relating to the employment contract. That doesn't fit here. This is a claim against injunctive relief. And it has nothing to do with the employment contract. Classification, commissions aren't even mentioned in that document. I see that my time is up. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all three of you for your helpful briefs and arguments. We appreciate it, and the case will be submitted.